Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome back to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with the industry's biggest names. Today's guest is Cassie Beck, who just started the tour of What the Constitution Means to Me. This show, if you didn't see it on Broadway, run to go see it wherever it is playing in your closest city. Right now, as we recorded this, it started in Minneapolis, and it's going to tons of major cities, Chicago, Boston, Detroit, Princeton, Dallas, Nashville, more. Go see it. She's actually a personal friend of Heidi Schreck's, and they worked so well, so closely together to translate it out of Heidi's story and make it Cassie's story, but still make it Heidi's story, but make it Cassie's story. She's an amazing human who you may know from The Humans. So before we get into the interview, as always, find me online on Instagram and Twitter at theater_podcast. Leave a rating and a review. Hit me up on Patreon. Let me know you're listening. And now, everybody, please enjoy this episode with Cassie Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Here you go, 1, 2, 3.
My guest today is a star of stage and screen whose previous credits include the recent revival of The Rose Tattoo and the original cast of The Humans on Broadway. And on TV, she's got credits with Pose, Elementary, Connecting, and Chicago Med. This fall, she will be busy leading the national tour of the direct-from-Broadway boundary-breaking play What the Constitution Means to Me and the much-anticipated Amazon Prime series I Know What You Did Last Summer. She can currently be seen opposite Mark Wahlberg in the feature film Joe Bell. Cassie Beck, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here, Alan.
You're so welcome, and it's so nice to see you this morning. And right before we were recording, you were saying that you had your first audience last night for Constitution.
Sure did. First preview, first show back, first time back in the theater. It was incredible. My first line is, "It's so good to see you." As you know, Constitution really breaks the fourth wall. It's a direct relationship to the audience. So I got to walk out in full light, and I'm not going to lie, I teared up. They would not stop clapping.
And this is in Minneapolis, yeah?
This is at the Guthrie, in Minneapolis. Yeah. We're kicking off the tour here. And they were so rowdy. I could hear them over the monitor before I went out. I was like, "Oh, they're rowdy. They're ready to be here." And we anticipated the excitement of, you know, it's the first time, I think it's in 18 months, that there's been a show at the Guthrie. So, and we are, Constitution is the only straight play on tour right now. So, I don't know. I was shocked when I heard that, but it just was thrilling to feel like, you know, we're representing Broadway out here, and people are stoked. And I knew it would be an electric moment, but I walked out and I was just me, and I'm standing there in front of all of them with the house lights completely up, and they would not stop clapping, and I had to make them stop, and I started crying, and I said, "You're gonna make me cry, and I haven't even started yet." But what a welcome, and just an electric night in the theater. I'm still basking in it. It was fun and important and deep and meaningful and all the feels. It just was incredible.
Was I guess did you see Constitution with Heidi Schreck when it was here in the city?
Oh yeah, New York.
Yeah, so, right. So 18 months has happened between then and now, and our country has changed. I don't know if it's for better or for worse yet. I've yet to decide, but like we're always evolving. 18 months is a long time in the political climate now. So seeing what Heidi did with it versus what you're doing with it now, is the message still the same or like has it, did you work with her and the directing team to adapt it? And also, I know this is like a bajillion part question, but she spoke personally, like this is my story. So you as not her telling this story, how has it been adapted and changed for you?
Yeah. Okay. I think I can break down all those things. So let's start with the current political climate.
Yes.
Heidi is still writing on the play. She's been in rehearsals. So she is with us and we are old friends. I've worked on her plays before and then we have a personal friendship as well. I saw it at New York Theater Workshop and I loved it. I was blown away by it and her performance. I just thought it was just a perfect night. I think I saw it the night Brett Kavanaugh was, I never know what's the exact term when you, I was like, not, it was an elected, nominated, not nominated, but when you like approved into the Supreme Court.
Not ratified. I know. It's on the tip of my tongue.
Me too.
Confirmed.
Yeah. Confirmed. After he was had his callback and was cast in the Supreme Court, I saw the show that night. And it was incredible. And so when the play kind of came around to me, I've told this story before, but I just was like, no way am I touching that with how perfect that was for me. You know, just selfishly, I just was like, no, I want it to remain in my memory and in the world the way I saw it with Heidi. And then I was like, well, let me read it. And I read it. And Heidi is a consummate playwright. She, as much as a performer, she is a writer. And I was like, oh, this is a play. When I was able to kind of take the performance out of my head and just read it in black and white, I saw that it was a play. And of course it is, because she's an excellent writer and the structure was there. And I started to kind of hear myself, I kind of see myself suddenly in it. And it's just like a character, you know, I am playing Heidi. I am still telling her story, but just like any character, you know, you're stepping in and bringing yourself to the role. I will never be Heidi, but I will never be any character that I embody completely. I have to bring myself to the story, and this is no different. And what she's done, I feel like, is she's built this kind of every woman in a way. And with its specificity comes the universality. We all know this with theater. That's why telling an intimate story can be so powerful. It's because people really can, through your story, discover themselves. And that's what I've been able to do. Heidi spends a lot of time talking about her kind of matriarchal line, her mother, her grandmother, and her great-great-grandmother. And I found that I was able to bring the ghosts of my mother and my grandmother and my great-great-grandmother on stage with me. And even though I am telling a story that's specific to Heidi's family, I'm imbuing it with my family history and what I know to be true about those women in my life as well. As far as the politics, I think, yes, a lot has changed. The show is changing with it. We are, for people who've seen the show, they'll know that the second half is a debate, a live debate. And there especially, we are really focusing on what's happening right now. In the play itself, there is some time spent on Roe versus Wade, on Roe v. Wade, a lot to do with kind of abortion law and the Ninth Amendment and the 14th Amendment especially. And mm-hmm. I guess I'll just say, as long as the Ninth Amendment and the 14th Amendment are relevant, we're going to have something to talk about. And I don't think those two things are going out of style anytime soon.
So those who don't know, what are the Ninth and the 14th Amendment?
Oh my gosh. The Ninth Amendment is what Heidi describes as a penumbra. Nobody really knows what it means, although it was the amendment that was used to make the case in Roe v. Wade that doctor and patient have a right to privacy. And that right to privacy is what the right to have an abortion falls under. And mm-hmm. so the Ninth Amendment was used to gain that right for women. And so that's Ninth Amendment primarily is what we talk. That's what we talk about in the show. 14th Amendment basically encapsulates all your human rights. So again, anytime we're talking about any kind of human right, we're talking about the 14th Amendment. We're talking, you know, equal protection clause, the due process clause. We go into it in the show in a very entertaining, humorous, funny way, full of emotion. It's not just a dry constitution lesson. There's a lot to enjoy about the show, but, right now Roe v. Wade may be, you know, back in the headlines and coming up into our consciousness.
Yeah.
In the Supreme Court here soon. There's the Texas abortion bill. All of these things are addressed in the second half of the play, is what I was saying, in the debate section. We're really making sure that we make those arguments, and we have some sharp, sharp debaters who have important things to say and opinions about their take on what's happening with the Constitution and with our future right now. So they're keeping me on my toes.
I'm looking at some of the cities that the tour is going to go through. And of course you mentioned you're opening in Minneapolis, but it's going to hit Chicago, Boston, Detroit, Princeton, Dallas, Nashville, more and more and more. I was looking for Texas cities. Dallas is in there. So have you and the team talked yet about, I guess, goodness, maybe protests, maybe like angry audience members? Like, politics are, of course, really dividing right now, but in the arts, I guess that maybe the people who would come see the show wouldn't necessarily be the ones who would disagree with the message of the show. But have you talked about the various audiences in the various cities specifically about this kind of thing yet?
And not about audience members. We've talked about, you know, making sure that we are topical with what's happening. I mean, we definitely have our eye on Texas. We have our eye on the Mississippi ban as well.
Mm-hmm. Even Nashville, yeah.
But I sort of feel like it's really a galvanizing force. There are going to be some people in Texas who are really going to need this support that this play offers. And I think for people who, I do think it's going to be a little self-selecting, you know, the audiences that come and don't, but you know, even if you don't agree with the politics in a lot of ways, I still feel like everybody has a role to play in equality. And that's at the heart of what's being told here. And I do think there's a chance to open some hearts and change some minds. And like, the end is a debate. And we really do argue both sides of a debate. There is civil discourse on display here. And it's a lot of what we don't have right now. And there's something very moving and wonderful about watching people argue both sides of something articulately and with passion. It just shows that we can listen to each other and hear another side. And even the character of Heidi through the whole play, she doesn't have answers. She's trying to understand. She's asking questions. She's trying to put things together. She's talking about the penumbra. She's talking about the gray area of life. And you can come in with one view or the other, but really the questions are still what's up in the air here. This is about investigating and getting better. We're asking our government and our systems and our country to do better. And I think the pursuit of equality, true equality, is not partisan. It's just something that we have to continue to fight for every day So no matter what side you're on, I think it's, I think there's information here that is interesting and a touching story that is human.
But hasn't the quest for equality become a partisan issue because both the opposing sides are both, well, maybe one side more than the other, convinced right. that they know better on behalf of everybody else, right? So I'm not a political person. I mean, I'm obviously following what's going on, but like, I don't like to get into political debates. But maybe this is a bit of white cis male privilege talking, and I want to acknowledge that. And I haven't had to deal with the issues that a lot of my peers have had to deal with. And I'm always like, I'm just always about everyone should have their own choice and it's their bodies. They should do what they want. And I've never had to deal with the fact that I have to fight for a right to make a decision about my own body. Mm. And I acknowledge that privilege and I acknowledge that and whatnot, but I guess I don't know what my question is, but you were saying that the fight for equality is nonpartisan, but I see.
It should be. It should be nonpartisan.
Yes, it should be. Okay, yeah, we'll say it should be nonpartisan, but it has become this partisan thing. So it's interesting to me, I guess, how both sides of this are approaching it, and it just dates back to this archaic way of trying to control people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For sure.
And it's really frustrating. It's really absolutely frustrating. And have you talked to Heidi about, or has she told you what to expect in terms of like feedback she received when she was doing the run of like negative things or positive things even? Like, did you sit down and over a bottle of wine and say like, listen, this might happen to you because it happened to me?
Well, we sat down over Zoom. And had and had this conversation. Yes, and look, I hear what you're saying. I'm not saying I don't know if it's a play for everyone. I like to think so because I think some people just don't know. They think they know, but you don't know what you don't know, right? And this play's got statistics and not alongside a personal story. Some facts about and some statistics about what's actually going on in the country and how many people are affected and not protected by this document. And I think it can be eye-opening to discover these things for a lot of people. But I did talk to her about it and, I think for the most part, it's a pretty energizing kind of galvanizing experience. She got a lot of, I think, support and some people who didn't realize where we were as a country with these rights, who thought they knew and then discovered, wow, we didn't really know. She did say that she probably got some Twitter trolls. I think that was sort of where she found the most of them is coming out online, which I anticipate too, but what are you going to do?
Yeah. I wonder if people are going to be able to separate the person from the character too. I totally forget her name right now. Anna Gunn, who played, Skyler on Breaking Bad, right?
Right.
I talked to her once and she said she got so much hate online for being this horrible person. And she's like, you realize I'm an actor playing a role, right? Like I am not Skyler White. I am Anna Gunn.
Yeah, totally.
So obviously like maybe Heidi's a little bit different because she wrote it and she was playing the character. But now, you, Cassie, are playing the character that Heidi has created. So I know for those listening, always remember that the character is separate from the actor.
Although it is confusing in this one because Heidi was playing Heidi, Heidi was being herself and there is no character of Heidi except for me. I have to make a character of Heidi so that I can step into it. But mm-hmm. Heidi was being Heidi and that's what's so great. That's so amazing about this playing crazy and brave and bold and raw is that she did just go out there and say, no, this is what's happening. We need to wake up to all of this. And I'm going to use myself. I'm going to walk through these questions. I'm going to walk through this emotion right in front of you in real time. And I'm going to ask you to do the same. And just like any relationship that is important to you, you have a relationship with the Constitution and you have a civic duty. And if it's important to you, like any good relationship, you're going to spend some time thinking about it and you're going to spend some time working on it. And here, let me demonstrate how to do that for 90 minutes. And she's like, I don't have the answers. But
you know
this is where we are.
How I love that there are kids involved, right? That are part of the debate. And you know, Heidi herself raised her college tuition debating doing Constitution debates when she was in high school. So like, it's important to get the younger generation involved in this. And in this country too, I think there's two things that are completely lacking, maybe three: financial education, political education. Aside from, you know, we hear like, here's how our country was founded, and founding fathers did all these great things. You know, but you ignore all the land and disease that we stole and gave to people. So political education, financial education, and sexual education, I think, are completely lacking as a standard across this country. But in terms of getting young people involved, I think that's part of one of my favorite things about Constitution, is because it's making it accessible, especially for young people of color too, which being a woman and being a woman of color in this country are not two of the easier things to be.
Right. Yeah. It's incredible. The young people, we have two debaters with us on tour, and you know, they come in with their own style and they come in with their own stories, and it's Emmeline Toffler and Jocelyn Scheck, and they are killing it. I remember when I saw it, when Heidi did it at New York Theater Workshop, and when the debater turned the corner is actually when I lost it in the audience, because it's so hopeful to hear these articulate young women and young people, not just young women, young people, so passionate about their futures and where we're going and what's right and wrong. And they're so smart, and they know so much more than about the Constitution than I do. But it's inspiring, really. It's hopeful.
I love the accessibility that this brings, and there's a lot of in general, right? I'm gonna take a step back, big picture. You're looking at art. Art heals. Art educates. Art informs. Art can, and especially theater and musical theater too. But like last night, I literally just went and saw Six for the third time, and that's a history lesson about Henry VIII, and again, antiquated ways of how women are only valued by who they're married to.
Right.
It's this bigger message that it's fun, it's comedic, but yet at the walking out, you're like, oh yeah, there's more to this. And so Constitution did this. I mean, even look at the difference Hamilton is making in the industry, right? And then as an educational form, they're busing in students and they're making sure that it's as accessible as it can be, because Broadway prices, ticket prices exclude a lot of people who need to hear the messages of the shows. So I just love when these things start to do social good outside of just trying to do ticket sales on Broadway. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the politics of the show are the politics of the people who made it. And so there's a huge consciousness around all of these issues, you know, accessibility. It's crazy that we're going out on tour and we're going to all the cities where Heidi traveled at age 15 and got all her prize money to go to college to get the education that ended up making this play. And now we're turning it a full circle and we're going back to those cities and we're here's what we learned. You know, here's what we learned. And it is amazing. Last night we had a real mix of ages. I mean, several generations in that audience. So we had, you know, are wonderfully angry blue-haired ladies who I feel like kind of lived through a lot of what maybe Heidi's mom and grandma went through, recognizing themselves, seeing themselves up on that stage. There's people of my generation recognizing themselves and seeing themselves on stage. And then, like you said, there's young people coming on and everything in between. And I have to say, it was amazing to hear their responses, because it really was in different parts of the show. I could hear whole groups of people identifying with certain parts of the show.
Wow.
And it was great. It was fantastic. And because we're all just in there in a room together, we're all sharing this together. And it really does speak to a broad range of people.
We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the episode.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I want to actually now back out and talk about you, Cassie, because I want to know what got you into theater. Where did you see the bug? Did you go see a show when you were a kid, like Constitution, and you're like, I want to do that?
Well, yes. When I was 8 years old, I saw The Music Man at the Redlands Bowl, which is where I grew up in Redlands, California. And I like wanted to punch that girl playing Amaryllis and step into her shoes. I'm like, let me at it. Dying to get on that stage. I grew up dancing, really. I was mostly a dancer until high school. And then I did my first show in high school. Really my first play. I kind of came at it late. And it's funny, this actually circles back to Constitution, because one of the things that Heidi's doing for all the people that play Heidi is she gives them a breakout moment to talk, to say, I'm not really Heidi, I'm Kathy. And this is the story I tell in the play, actually, as the first play that I did in high school. And I grew up mostly in California in a military family, but when I was 15, my dad got a job in Mississippi. And so we moved to a small, small rural town in Mississippi. And I was in culture shock for sure. And this drama club got started at this high school that I dropped into in the middle of being 15 and all that comes with that. And I joined that drama club and we did a play and we won the state competition and we won the regional competition. Then we got to go all the way to the national competition. And I don't really think this high school or this town knew what to do with this. This like drama club that was suddenly like winning stuff. Not that I believe that art should be competitive, but you know, that's how it was at the time. And I remember when we won the nationals, we came back and like the town had lined the streets and they had posters and they were like, they were like, welcome us back in. Like we're a sports team. Like yeah. We were a sports team, you know?
I was gonna say, it sounds like a ticker tape parade.
Totally. And I was like, oh, this is happening. Okay. But that's when I really got the bug for acting. I wanted to dance and be in musicals, but I ended up going to the University of Memphis for undergrad, and they didn't do musicals, really. They did mostly, they were very play-centered and kind of all genres. Like they're, you know, they were doing Greek tragedy and all kinds of things. And I always felt really behind. When I got there, a lot of the other students had gone to like Governor's School in Tennessee and had done all the summer camps and they'd read all the Shakespeare plays and like, you know, they were serious. And I came in and I was like, I've been in Guys and Dolls in high school, you know, but so I always felt a little behind. And it's funny, you know, I actually did not get cast until my junior year. I did a lot of like, smaller projects with the director, with the grad directing, the MFA directing students, but mm-hmm. not the quote unquote main stage until. And so, you know, I had 2 years where I really, it was humbling. I was learning a lot. And then I kind of got my feet underneath me, sort of figuring some stuff out. And after I graduated, I went to a training program called The Warehouse in Greenville, South Carolina. And I worked with 11 other kind of students slash company. It was a semi-professional company. So we did do performances of a full season, but we were also in class and training. Mm-hmm. And then I got my first professional gig at the Napa Valley Shakespeare Festival. I just went to the Bay Area and did a general audition out of nowhere. I flew myself out from South Carolina. I did it. I didn't want to go to New York. I didn't want to go to LA, but I kind of wanted to get back towards California. That's where my family was. So, you know, grew up in California, spent a little time in the South, headed back to California. No designs on New York ever, really. I don't know why. I think I was scared of it, probably. Didn't really know that much about it. Cut to, I ended up staying in the Bay Area for about 8 years. I did a lot of, like, basement theater, you know, a lot of more experimental stuff. Mm-hmm. We were doing, like, Naomi Wallace and Eric Gend and Lisa D'Amore and really interesting, cool stuff especially with a theater company called Crowded Fire Theater Company. I was asked to join their ensemble. So for I think 5 or 6 years, I was a part of the acting ensemble there. And that was fantastic. What was ended up happening is San Francisco is sort of this hotbed for new work. They have what they call the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. And mm-hmm. every year, you know, New York writers and local writers there would bring their new plays. And I, for whatever reason, just got a crash course in new play development there. A lot of the regional theaters there, Berkeley Rep as well, Theater Works in Palo Alto, they're working on new plays. And mm-hmm. so kind of by accident, that's the way my career went. And I became friends with Adam Bach, who lived in the Bay Area for a while, but had been in New York for a bit. And he wrote a role for me in a play called The Drunken City. And then Playwrights Horizons picked that play up. And he said, well, I have somebody. And they brought me out to do the workshop. And that was the second time I had ever been in New York. My mom took me for a graduation trip when I graduated from college. And that's the only time I'd ever been in New York. And so here I am, and I'm showing up at Playwrights Horizons to do a reading. And did this reading with Soo Jin Kim and Maria Dizia, you know, and like, I didn't know who I just was so naive. I miss those days. I was so naive. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what to be scared of. So I wasn't scared.
Oh, that's the best. That's the best.
I know.
When you don't know how hard something is, so you just go do it, and then you look back and you're like, holy shit. And
you're like, what the heck? I can't believe I did that. Yeah. I know, totally. I did, and Trip Coleman directed. And, okay. And then I got to do it. And so at this point, also back at Crowd of Fire in San Francisco, the founding artistic director had stepped down, and I stepped in as artistic director. So I had just taken over as artistic director of this small, grungy theater company. And then I was like, I'm going to go do this play real fast in New York, and I'm coming right back. And that didn't happen. I got to New York, and I got cast in a couple of other shows. And my husband was like, you know what? Just write it out and see. If you get an agent, then you should stay for a year, and just we'll see. And so all that ended up happening, and then cut to. We ended up moving. but Crowd of Fire is doing well. I just want to plug it because it is still, it's fantastic. It's doing great. It's lived on and gone through a couple artistic directors now, and they're fantastic.
Oh, awesome. What's the website where people can check it out?
Crowdoffire.org.
There you go. So then at what point does the TV and film start to creep its way in? Because a lot of the credits film here in New York, But I was looking at the other thing, like this stuff that's coming out now. I Know What You Did Last Summer, of course, is this much anticipated modern take on the 1997 horror film that, of course, is around the same thing. So where did the TV and film side come into all this?
Oh, my God. So I had no training on camera. I feel like I'm the end of a generation for whom, you know, you kind of felt like you could just do a theater career somehow. Now, I have so much respect for the young people who show up in New York at 18, 20, 22, because I do think the expectation now is that you can do some crossover stuff. And I never had, you know, in my BFA and even extra theater training, I never had on camera training. And back to the Drunken City, I remember we opened and my little face was in the New York Times. and I was subletting and sleeping on somebody's futon. And the day after it opened, my phone rang and I answered it, and it was Law and Order wanting me to come for an audition.
I hope when they call you, it always starts with dun dun.
There's dun dun dun. That's how I knew who it was.
Yeah.
And they called to ask if I, you know, and I didn't have an agent, I didn't have any representation, so they're just calling me straight up on my cell phone. You know, like back in the day, like can you come in tomorrow? And I was like, what? I don't even know what this is, and It was terrifying. And I never did get on a Law and Order. I've never been on a Law and Order. I'm one of those theater actors that's never been on Law and Order. But it came slowly. I got some auditions kind of right away off just, I think, being kind of a new person in New York. And, you know, I came to New York when I was 30. I didn't come when I was 18 or 20. So I had a little bit of experience and a little bit of grounding, but not for TV and film. I did not know how to do any of that stuff. And so I started taking some classes, and I just kind of slowly started to figure it out. I have to say, I feel like with the self-tape situation, I have fared much better. I've kind of figured out the self-tape, which has helped in the last couple of years. And yeah, I Know What You Did Last Summer was a self-tape. Joe Bell was a self-tape. A lot of what I've booked has been that. So there is hope out there for people who feel like you're making self-tapes and sending them out to the void. Same girl, same, but every now and then it happens. I Know What You Did Last Summer, shot in Hawaii.
Really?
Yeah.
That sounds really hard.
I know. It was awful. Everyone's going to hate me. I'm going to turn off the podcast at this point. I was married there, and I'd been there several times. I hadn't been back since, I think 2007. And I think it was originally going to shoot in LA, but then because of the pandemic and the way, COVID was working, it was safer actually in Oahu. So we went for safety, Alan.
Aww.
And, yeah. And then when I got it, they said, oh, so 6 months in Oahu. So I got to fly out and take my dog and, you know, be out there and shoot. We shot all over that island. It was crazy fun. I was nervous in a lot of ways because I don't have a ton of experience, but I've got to say every experience I've had has been amazing. And the New York shows too. I got to do Pose with Patti LuPone.
Yeah.
So like amazing. You know, Elementary was with all those guys and that was fun. And I did The Humans for a long time with Sarah Steele and, you know, learned all about The Good Wife and got to ask my questions. So, you know, leaning on our friends too helps.
When you're in these situations, you know, you're kind of, obviously you have the talent to be where you are, otherwise you wouldn't be there. But when you're first coming into these moments and you're around, you know, you're going in a Pose and you're in a scene with Patti LuPone and you're in this movie opposite Mark Wahlberg and these people that just we've known about and watched and seen forever. And then all of a sudden you're with them. Do you have this moment of like, wow, I shouldn't be here? Or are you like, this is it? This is, you know, I'm buckling down. And of course, you know, I guess bringing it full circle to what we said earlier was, if you knew how hard it was, you wouldn't have done it. But now you're there, so you have to do it.
Yeah, I don't freak out till after. I don't know what it is about me. I'm a very late bloomer. It takes me a long time to process stuff. I kind of show up and I'm like, well, I'm here and I'm showing up and I'm doing it and I've prepared and I'm here. And then I do it. And then later I'm like shaking in the bathtub, you know, like, I can't believe that just happened. The story with Patti LuPone is actually great because, we know each other a little bit, from the humans. I got to go do it in London as well. And she was there doing Company at the time. Mm-hmm. So our whole cast went to see Company and got to go backstage and sit in her dressing room with Michael Kors for a little while. And so I know her a bit, not a ton, but a bit. And so she had a recurring role, an arc on Pose, but that day that I shot with her was her first day on set and her first scene. And so we were in the trailer together doing makeup and hair, and I just reintroduced myself and said hi, and she recognized me, which was a relief. And then I actually think it was sort of a kind of universal kind of meeting moment, spiritual, special moment for us, because I think she was nervous, you know? And it's like, she's this legend and she's this amazing person, of course, and this amazing actor and has so much experience, but they're all just people. And that's my answer to your question about like Mark Wahlberg and all these people. Like, how I remember it is because I see their humanity. They're just us, you know? We're all the same. And she at one point was like, I'm so glad you're here. Because I was another theater person, you know, that she knew a little bit and had a little grounding with, you know, and there's a sea of faces that she doesn't know, and all the cameras on her, and she's Patti LuPone walking in, and there's like, and I got to be that little person for her that just kind of, I don't know if she ever needed it, could be a little anchor, you know, for her of familiarity. And at one point, you know, and then they put her in this amazing costume, and then they hand her two little dogs. And they're like, here's two little dogs and sit and now monologue, go. And I was like, oh, I'm here for you, Patti. I'm right here. I'm here for you. Whatever you need. And she looks up and she's like, do I look okay? And I'm like, yes, you look amazing. You're doing amazing. So I think that's one thing to just remember, you know, with casting directors too, or directors, or anytime you're in a situation with somebody where there's a perceived either like power balance or maybe like a fangirling going on, just remember they're just people too.
I wonder, and I haven't actually thought about this in a long time. I used to think about this, is the people like Patti LuPone or, you know, like your Mark Wahlbergs or even, you know, Katrina Lenk or these famous people in the industry, in whatever industry they're in, I wonder, and you've worked with these people and you were just saying, speaking of this a little bit, but I wonder the pressure that they feel, like Meryl Streep, right? You just expect everybody, the world expects her to just get Oscar nominations falling out of her ass. Mm-hmm. So the fact that she walks in and she's like, oh God, I got to make this one as good as the last one. I got to make this one better than the last one. And you know, Patti, right, is saying, do I look okay? I'm glad you're here. I'm, you know, obviously she's getting a little nervous. Have you seen this and do you experience it too a little bit where you're like, okay, I'm here. I've been doing this for a long time, but there's still the pressure to perform and be as good or better every single time. Or you just kind of say like, screw it, I'm going with it.
I think it's both. It just depends on the day. It's where I'm at. You know, I don't believe you're only as good as your last performance. I don't believe that. I don't think that's true. I think we're in a evolution all the time and we're in a process all the time. And I think actors have bad days, you know, like just like everybody. I mean, I love reality cooking shows because I feel like that show, you know, you see these great, great chefs that just like cannot handle the challenge or cannot handle competition, but they're great chefs, you know, and actors are great actors. And sometimes they're not right for everything or every moment, you know? And, so, So I don't believe I have to be better than what I did before. I think I just have to be as good as I can possibly be in this moment every time.
I love that answer. That's a beautiful answer. And I think that is a wonderful place to transition into our final three questions that I ask everybody to wrap up the episodes. Okay. The very first one, just very simply, is what motivates you?
I think personal challenge, by curiosity.
And then second question then, if you could give advice to your younger self and younger people listening now, starting out down a similar path, what would you say?
I would say, go where you can get better. Go where you can do your best work. I was given that advice as a young person. That's why I didn't come to New York right away. I knew that I was going to do better in an ensemble situation in a smaller city with time. And that's just the way my process was and kind of where my training was at. And I didn't want to go to New York and kill what I loved. And okay. I knew I wasn't ready. Yeah.
Okay, so last question. This is the hardest one. If you can only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Angels in America.
Ooh, that's a new one. A new one, a new answer.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant.
I'm evaluating now. I'm thinking back towards the answers. Before the pandemic, the most common answer was Sweeney Todd. And I haven't heard that from hardly anybody since the pandemic. And I wonder if that's because people want more optimism.
I was going to say, what is the answer? What is the answer post-pandemic?
It's all over the place.
It's
really all over the place. But yeah, interesting. Okay, so where can we find you online?
Or maybe Strange Loop.
Ooh, yes. That's a new one. I like that.
That show's amazing.
Yes. So where can we find you online? What are your socials?
I'm at Cassie Bexter, kind of across the board, and Cassie Beck on Insta.
Great. I am online at thetheaterpodcast.com. You can find me on Instagram at Twitter at theater_podcast. Leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening. This has been edited by Well-Rounded Hoodlum Productions, music by Jukebox the Ghost, and conversation by Cassie Beck. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.